Hi everyone, welcome to North and South Pods. Please share, subscribe, like, get involved in any way you can, and if you can, financially contribute for the cost of a cup of coffee once a month on coffee.com, all in the notes. I haven't said that for a while, but I just thought I'd remind you of the good work you're all doing by supporting this podcast. It's a real honour today to have on John Smith, who I've been trying to get on for a while. He's a very popular guy, but I actually saw him do a presentation a few weeks ago about self-defence to do with knife crime, which has had an impact in the area around Hope Street and Ormskirk. There's been a couple of cases there. John has got a military background. He's also heavily involved in things like martial arts, and he works with Kev Mack, who's been on the podcast before, and they've got their own gym together. Is that right, John? Do you want to just introduce yourself and tell us what you're doing at the minute?
Yeah, so me and Kev, as you've had on as a guest, and he told me about the podcast and told me how good it was. And he said, you know, it might be a good fit for you to maybe jump on with you, Tim. And like you said, we've been trying to do this forever. I think it's forever, hasn't it? And finally, randomly, we met up. That was so weird for me. And I just felt so embarrassed because I'd been saying, yeah, I'll do it. And then I was always sort of letting you down. It felt like I was letting you down. And then I had nowhere to run then, did I? I run ASW Liverpool with Kev. We are co-owners, and we both teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, submission wrestling, submission grappling at our own academy. Known Kev for quite a long time now. It's a great partnership. We are two different characters, so there's no clashing. You know, it's like, yeah, two people are quite the same. Mm. You can sort of clash, you know, like two batteries, isn't it, going together, and they can sort of clash. And we're just the opposite type of people, I would say, but with a shared goal and this shared vision of teaching people good skills within Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and submission grappling world. So, yeah, that's my job.
Cool.
And I love it. I love it.
Brilliant. Is there anything else you're involved in at the minute? Because I know you came to Hope Street. You're very interested in things like self-defence and being prepared for eventualities that the average person might not always think about. So when you did the talk at Hope Street recently, you were talking about like knife crime and what to do if there's been knife crime and what you need to do. You showed us some of the equipment. And you also referred to like equipment that you have in your car, because when there's an accident in a car, in those minutes it takes the emergency services to get there, things can go wrong big time. So you kind of have things in your car, don't you, that can help you in those eventualities?
Yeah, nothing special really. Obviously, come up in the background, I've got been in the military, previously in the military, and then I spent like 10 years as a security contractor as well, working in hostile countries. So that taught me to be prepared, either working as a team, we were always prepared for something more. I spent a bit of time working on my own, so I always had to be prepared on my own. And then I wanted to bring those skills that I had and I utilised over, I'd say, in total, like 23 years in total. I wanted to retain those skills for myself, share those skills with, like, some of the skills with my family so they were prepared. And they're now, like, sort of with the community. So I run, like, small little courses for people, little groups who get in touch with me through my Instagram. And then I seen, obviously, I'm quite I live in this town called Ormskirk. It's a small town. So when something bad happens, sort of everyone hears about it. And I think it became apparent that something was going to happen soon. And I'd reached out to Hope Street last year and said, look, I've got some knowledge on keeping people alive, keeping yourself alive. If I can share it with the community, I will do. And nothing really happened again. It probably could have been me. It could have been me just being busy. And then when that recent attack happened, I was like, right, we've got to do something here. So I got in touch with them, and hopefully that was a little intro to who I am. And we can sort of potentially do some training for the community where we can cover sort of basic trauma first aid. Not your ABC stuff where we're talking, you know, the basic life support. But like when someone gets stabbed, how can we stop this from alcohol? Because that's what's going to, if someone does get stabbed, it's not, you know, CPR is not helping. Yeah. It's stopping that bleed. And it's really simple stuff. Yeah. You don't need to be some specialist medic. You just need to know a few little things and have a few bits of kit on you that you can just get off Amazon. So, you know, that's the stuff I carry on with me every day. I carry some in my car, on my person, just in the event that I may end up either witnessing, I may be a part of, and then, or just like you talked about, the sort of road traffic collision stuff. Last Saturday, there was an upturned car on the M58. I didn't have to stop. There was four cars that stopped. But if I was that first car there, what would be the point of me pulling over if I'm not prepared to deal with a casualty? What, to be a bystander and call an ambulance? Well, you know, that's all you could do, really, isn't it? So I make sure I've got enough kit and equipment with me to, if I do have to pull over, I can treat someone, keep them alive. What if I'm in the car? It's my RTC. I keep myself alive until someone comes, because as we know, sometimes an ambulance doesn't come as quickly as we need it. And so, yeah, that's me just being prepared and trying to share that with the community.
Brilliant. Yeah, and you spoke very well in that presentation, and it's great work that you're doing. Do you know, you were talking about your military background. Obviously, that changes you. You know, 23 years, it changes your perceptions of the world, etc. How did you get into that? Was it kind of through family, or was it a career that interested you? How did you get into that military?
So, as a kid, I was the kid who just like wanted to be Rambo all the time. I loved war movies. I collect the posters from like the local video shop up in Kirby. By Kirby train station, be video shop up there. And I'd visit them all the time. And I'd go, "You got some of your old posters?" And Rambo 3 would be out. And I'd go, "You got a poster for me?" And he'd always give me posters. I'd adorn my wall with them. Commando, First Blood, and at the military with a gun. I was the kid, man. I had like an arsenal of weaponry at home. I loved it. And then obviously you sort of grow up a little bit and you leave school, and it was always something there in the back of my head. But looking back now, I wasn't making good choices. Drinking on the streets like kids do, you know, taking drugs and stuff like that. I was getting into that. I was working at the time as an apprentice plasterer, and it just wasn't doing it for me. It really wasn't. And one day I was working in Liverpool, and there's a careers office there, and I just out of nowhere, I just went in, spoke to the guys. They sold it to me within 2 minutes. I was sold. I went back a week later and signed up. I think my parents had signed the documents, because I was like 16 at the time, and I was all in. A friend of mine was going to join with me. He didn't. Well, two friends, both of them didn't join. I went on my own. One guy had a girlfriend, and that kept him from going. And then the other guy, I can't tell you the story. They made up a lot of bullshit when he went. He went and did his test, and he came back and said, like, yeah, well, it wasn't for him, let's put it that way. Yeah. But it was for me, and that was it. That was it. I loved that life for said period of time. So that's how I got into it.
So did you feel like that kind of discipline, testing yourself, because it's not for everyone. I've done the assault course that they do in the army when I went on work experience. I mean, I was in my 30s when I did that, and I didn't like climbing over that thing, you know, where you have to go over the top and the net came down the other side, and that. I was thinking, oh, I'm not good with heights. But did you feel early on it just felt good to you, it felt right to you, it all came together?
Yeah, I think I was scared of going back home too, as a disappointment, as a failure. I think you know, it's quite hard. I'm 44 now, so it was a long time ago when I was there. I was only a kid, and there was grown men there, like men. I couldn't shave. You know, I had a shaving kit that stayed in my locker. You had to have like a set amount of kit. It never got used, and they'd say to you all the time, "Well, I haven't used your shave kit." And I'm grow a beard, mate. You know? I'm 16 years of age. I don't even think I had hair under my armpits. You know, I was that young. So I think it was quite intimidating as well. But I had some really good instructors who seen the potential in me, and I was willing to give it maximum for them. I got best recruit as a 16-year-old when I'm with grown men on this course. So my first phase, best recruit. So I was really proud of that at the time. I then went into like the second phase. I had a little bit of a harder time there. The course was not any more difficult. It was my combat infantryman's course. But you come with, like, when you get that best recruit, you come then with a little package behind you, and got a bit of bullying. I would call it bullying. I've got a little bit of heat on my ass for that. So, yeah, it made it a little bit more difficult for me, but it was no stress. I passed no worries, and I went to my battalion at 17. I was 17. I moved to Germany as a 17-year-old. Spent 5 years in Germany, first 5 years in the military.
So at the time, Britain had military bases in Germany still. I don't think they have them anymore, did they? So you were based over there doing training, just readiness for
Just,
war if needed.
yeah, Spain, really. At the time, there was no conflicts really going on. The Northern Ireland conflict was sort of withering down. I did end up deploying there anyway for, I think I did a total of 2.5 years there with different jobs I was doing. But we were geared up for when I went, there was nothing going on. And then there was sort of the Bosnia conflict. We got pinged to go out there. We had to two rotations, 2 6-month tours out to Bosnia. It was not worth talking about now, to be fair. Nothing really happened to us. We spent our time drinking beers and having a good time. We did patrolling, but it was not the level of patrolling life I got used to. Very low-level stuff, gathering information on water, electricity, humanitarian stuff. Did a rotation out to Kosovo when the conflict had just started. And I think we were the first unit to do a 6-month rotation there after the invasion. I think it was a parachute regiment went in first, and then we went in straight after them, and we did the first 6 months in there inside Pristina City. That was really exciting. Really enjoyed myself. Very good for patrol skills, learning low-level patrol skills, working as a team type stuff. And just sort of, I was a junior commander at that time as well. For me, it was like where I sort of started to learn my trade a little bit, and yeah, really enjoyed that. And then I think I moved on to Northern Ireland, rotation in Northern Ireland. And I think it was at that time, it was in my 7 year point. So I got a little bit disillusioned with what was going on. British military were involved in two wars at this stage, Afghanistan and Iraq. And my unit was missing out each time on these, just totally due to unlucky, this is where you are in the rotation between all these other regiments. And I was like, you know what? We're never going to go. It'll be over before we go. And I left the military for 3 months. 3 months later, I couldn't. 3 months later, I realized I'd made a big mistake. I was back home. I'd had a young kid at the time, married. And I was like, I think I've made a mistake here. I wasn't finished. So got back in touch with my old unit, and he went, look, we're going to go on a 2 year tour to Northern Ireland. There's potential of a specialist role there for you if you want to come back in. So that's what I did. I joined back up again. Took me a few weeks to get back in. And then I redeployed out to Northern Ireland for a 2 year tour doing covert reconnaissance. So yeah,
Interesting.
I loved that. It was an amazing job. It was
Now,
amazing.
if you think about it, the kind of Northern Ireland, the Yugoslav wars, Kosovo, they kind of did resolve themselves, and you might look back at them and go, those things ended and progress has been made. And when you're there, are you thinking more about like your specific job, or do you have one eye on that kind of like bigger picture? Because we'll come to Afghanistan and Iraq in a minute. But it sounds to me like you just wanted to get in there and just have the experience of being in there to do your job. Is that how you approached each day, just trying to do the best you could, as it were?
I would say so, yeah. The Bosnia stuff, the Kosovo, there was no sort of looking to that bigger picture for someone like me, junior commander. I just need to look after eight blokes. That's all I've got to do. 4 to 8 guys, look after them, do a good job, keep them safe, carry out your tasks, what you've got to do. And that was it, really. The sort of where you start looking at the bigger picture was like the sort of second Northern Ireland tour where you're sort of a more of a strategic task, a strategic unit where you're carrying out surveillance and stuff. So you've got to understand then the bigger picture of what you're doing. And then that sort of then leads into then understanding like the global scale of war and the effects of war when it comes to like Afghanistan and Iraq. And it was Iraq that I went to first. And again, there was a huge build-up for that for us. We knew when we were going, our sister unit was out there and they were having like a horrendous time of fighting. I think between my unit and their unit, we picked, and I'm glad when we went I'm glad we didn't go before, because there was a lot of sort of peacekeeping elements to Iraq after the initial invasion, and we didn't get that. We went in full speed ahead. The insurgency had kicked up massively in 2007, and we were pushed out to go and sort of quell that insurgency. And it was an amazing time, let's just say that.
It's interesting because the actual invasion of Iraq was over very quickly. The whole kind of Iraqi state collapsed in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. Victory was declared famously by George Bush. It then subsequently turned out that no planning had really been made about the post-war situation by the American authorities. Britain kind of was a junior partner. So is it fair to say that you went in just as that huge kind of problem on the ground, the insurgency was kicking off? It took a year or two, didn't it, before it really picked up after the war? I think it was by about 2005-6 the insurgency on the ground in Iraq really kicked off. You had all that kind of infighting between different Iraqi groups, then against the invaders, as many people saw it. So when you went in there, were you really at the thick of that? And were you based in the south? Is it by Basra in the south? That's where the British were, isn't it?
Yeah, so I was based at Basra Palace. It's the only base, one or two bases that were left in the city. We had a location called the PJCC, very small location, with a small unit there, and then our units at the palace. Everyone else was sort of pushed out to the sort of airfield. The insurgency was in full swing. It was Iranian-backed. They were fighting against the Josh Ahmadi insurgency. And for us as a like sort of unit, we weren't even looking about, we weren't even thinking about the humanitarian side of it. We were not thinking about the bigger picture. All we cared about was going to kill people, and that's the truth. I'll be dead honest. We didn't care about anything else. I hear about, you know, people, you're queen and country. There was none of that in my unit. I never knew anyone who fought for queen or country. Never. I hear about it a lot. Our soldiers, they fight for queen and country. We didn't. We went there because we wanted a war. That's what we wanted. We'd been sitting, and I think we were quite unique. All these other units had gone, and we're sitting watching everyone. And it gets you down, because we were carrying out training for other units that were going. And we're like, when's it our turn? And luckily for us, quite luckily, I would say, we went at the height of the insurgency. So we got what we wanted, like very quickly, very, very quickly. We got what we wanted. And it was a shock to a lot of people, because we talked a big game. We really did. At that time, I was a section commander. So you're sort of like, you section commanders are the guys who sort of run everything that goes on. Like, you've got your officer element, your senior NCO element, and then the junior commanders, the corporals, etc. They're the ones, they're the war fighters. They're the ones who are commanding the guys on the ground. I was luckily in that position at that time. And the group of us, because we, no matter where you are in the battalion, those sort of guys, we're all friends. We're all at the same level. We're all mates. And all of us just wanted to go to war and just destroy. That's what we wanted to do. And we got that. We really did. And we had I might as well talk about it now. We had it was an awakening very, very quickly. One of our commanders, one of my teammates, Jez Brooks, he was in the same team as me. He was another commander in my platoon. He was killed. He was the first guy who got killed out of our unit. And he was killed very quickly. It was probably one of our first operations as a unit, as a battalion. I think it was day 11. Me and Jez had flown over from Kuwait. The command team had gone over to do the reconnaissance, to do the recces with the older unit to see what the ground looked like. And I think we spent 11 days there together, getting prepared for our platoon to come. And we just brief them up, this is how it's going to work when you're here. And I think it was on our... I think it's the second day working as a company level, and he was killed in an ambush. So that was like, it was a massive rude awakening to people. It really was, that someone as good as this guy. And that's what it made me realise, it doesn't matter how good you are. And I've learned that now through all these years. It doesn't matter how good you are, how well trained you are, you can be the number one guy and you can just get killed. It's just, it is what it is. It's war. And the enemy has a say in the battle. And if you're an occupying force like we are, they have an opportunity to blend in their environment. And it's very easy for you to get ambushed, very easy. And that's what happened to us. We'd been out on a tasking overnight. We'd went out the net, we'd rolled straight into a second tasking. We literally got back in, we turned round, we didn't get out the vehicles. We turned back and went back out for another task. And we'd stayed in the city, I think, far too long. And it'd give the insurgency a time to identify where we were and set up an ambush on our way back. And that's what they did. I didn't know about Jez's death initially. I didn't know until I got back. I was one of the last members to get back in that night. But Jez was killed like pretty early on in probably one of the first engagements. We'd been ambushed up with RPG, small arms fire. They disabled a vehicle. Disabled several vehicles. And Jez had been killed. So in that sort of confusion, a lot of communication can be lost. And a very good friend of mine, he'd driven Jez back. He was one of Jez's riflemen. He'd driven him back. He knew he was dead. He was a dead body in the back of his vehicle. He'd driven him back. And pretty much the whole unit went back with them. And like two of us, like our two little trucks, had stayed out in the middle of the city to sort of protect these vehicles that were hit because they needed to get, we couldn't hand them over. The armored vehicles, they'll just take them and use them. So I didn't even notice that I was there. You know, the communication was pretty poor that day. And it was like, right, we're staying here. We're going to protect these vehicles until some support. And then we just got ambushed for hours. And just they were just 316 or my small group of guys for several hours, I think it was, about 3 or 4 hours until we could extract and more unit. I think it was only about four of us who were fighting troops at the time were fighting them.
Do you know that kind of situation? You know, it sounds to me like you're going in there, you want to do your job. There's an identifiable enemy, these insurgents, but they're mixed in. So your job is to get to them, to stop them from being able to do what they're doing. You know, kind of rationalises the whole thing as well, doesn't it, for you? But you do all this training and, you know, prepare for things. I spoke to a guy called Alex on a podcast I recorded last week, and he suffered from PTSD. He was in Afghanistan, and he was involved in an ambush where he was describing there's people shooting at him. And he's out in the open shooting at them. And no one got hit in this ambush. Because, like, you have this idea, don't you, that when there's an ambush, everyone gets killed. And, you know, you watch things on films, don't you, etc. But what's it like when you're in the thick of that? I mean, what do you say to yourself? Does your training kick in? You know, what are you doing when there's, like, 360 fire? Do you get in the vehicle and stay in there? You know, what's going through your mind in those kind of circumstances?
I said yes. Yes. I was so excited. I was like, yes, this is it. This is what I came for. And I left. It's a test, isn't it? I see it now as everything I've done was like a test. Any of these, like, these engagements or where I was put into a position where you might die today. I see it as looking back now, going, well, that was a test. It was a test. It was a pass or fail test. And I passed that test that day. I loved it. I was in my element. I've been training for this for 10 years. Mm. I've been in the military for 10 years now. I had a good, really good head on my shoulders at this stage. I was very knowledgeable about my job, about the jobs above me. So this was something that I could handle easily. The only thing that sort of let us down was sort of the understanding what was going on in the battle picture, because it was limited. I was a dismounted troop at the time, so I wasn't like driving a vehicle or on a machine gun in a vehicle, nothing like that. But I was in the vehicle with the guys who were doing that, a good friend of mine, Scotty. And communication was poor, there's noise, and we're getting RPGs. And you know, you've seen Black Hawk Down. Yeah. And I'm not joking, it was that first RPG that went past my head. I was like, wow, that's like Black Hawk Down. It felt like the movie. And I the phosphorus burning out in a wall next to me. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's like real, isn't it? That's what it looks like. And then, like, rounds pinging off and they're hitting your vehicle next, you know, that you're in. And you're like, oh, okay, let's have it. We got into engagements that day from a couple of hundred meters away in streets where they were hiding behind crowds of people all the way up to like close target engagements, 15, 20 meters in alleyways, like do it in the alleys around us. Vehicles coming up using civilian vehicles to drive up on us, and we just gun the vehicle up. We just gun it up because we knew what they were doing. They were just trying to get close to us with V-bids and stuff like that. But I think four of us were in the engagement that day on that little isolated bit, and it was great. I won't lie, it was like I was in my element. I really was in my element, and we were there for a long time. I think I fired off every round I had, all the spare. And then when we came back, when we got extracted that night, we got hit with an IED then as well. That was the time that really shook me a little bit. I was like, wow.
I was about to ask about them, because one of the big things was about whether the vehicles were able to resist IEDs, which is an improvised explosive device. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Also, when you addressed that, if an RPG hits a vehicle straight on, is the vehicle kind of got the armour to protect against that? Is that what those vehicles were designed to do?
Yeah. Our vehicle we had Israeli armor on ours. So the armor explodes on impact, so it doesn't impact the vehicle. So we were using this sort of new armor at the time. But the IED had gone off between two vehicles, so we didn't take a big impact. Our other vehicles on other patrols, we had a good friend of mine hit really bad in the vehicle in front of me. Several other guys hit that day with IEDs. So when we were fighting, the vehicles that came to support us, to extract us, they got hit with an IED, and the driver was blown out of the vehicle. So they were in their engagements. There was lots of little engagements all around. But getting back in that night, that sort of the last little vehicle to come back in, one had just gone off just before the gate. They knew what we were going to come back in. But I think a lot of that was fatigue, dehydration, food. I was just a bit nervous then after that. So... not at that time, it was like, wow, shit, been good all day. And it's the very end just before I'm getting in and like get a little bit shook up.
Do you know when you ran out of ammo, were you relieved fairly quickly after that, or did your colleagues still have a bit of ammo to keep people at arm's length? How did that work?
There's two lads in my vehicle that were non-warfighters. They were like communication specialists. I just took all their ammo off them.
Yeah. So you still had some by the end, yeah.
I used theirs as well.
Yeah. But theoretically, someone's coming to relieve you to help you get out of there eventually with the two vehicles. Is that what the theory was? You didn't want that other side getting the vehicles? Is that what the thinking was?
I think what they did, I think they brought fast air in. And they hit the vehicle with fast air, so an F-16 or so, or whatever, I don't know.
So then they can't use it.
A fast mover came in, I think, and destroyed it. And then we just extracted out. Yeah. That was day 11. Yeah. And that was the start of how it was going to go for the rest of the time there.
Do you know, was that like a typical thing for you? Driving around in vehicles, going into dangerous areas, you could be ambushed at any time, you've got IEDs... You've got potential threats everywhere. Was that like kind of your day-to-day stuff when you were outside the base? You were going around in that environment. Are you hyper 100%. Alert? I mean, you're on adrenaline all day in those kind of situations. Or do you get used to it?
No, I get used to it. There's always that fear element there because of the IED threat. They had us doing like really, looking back, it was terrible what we were doing. Like the SOP... For identifying IEDs was to get like dismounted troops like me to go on the ground and look for them. And not my unit, but the unit that was working with us, they lost like four guys doing that one night, all of them destroyed with an IED. And one of our other platoons had to go up and sort of clear that area of the bodies. And that's an horrendous thing to ask a guy to do. Look for IEDs with your eyes, with your real eyes, and you're like, come on. We've got armoured vehicles that will take the hit. It does cause CAS at times, but better than the guys on foot looking for them. But, yeah, we weren't always in vehicles. We did what's called strike operations. So we'd go to certain places and we'd hit buildings that we were looking for, targets of interest, where there's been engagement come from, or we had intelligence leading us to believe there's weapon caches and stuff like that, and we'd go on foot. Or we get dropped off by the vehicles and we'd hit them on foot. It was a great time, but there was a lot of loss. We lost good, really good people. A lot of good commanders who you'd never go they're the ones who will die. You can sort of pick the guys who, you know, who are not into it as much as you. The younger guys, they haven't bedded in yet. They haven't learned their role of what a warfighter does. And it was the senior guys, the guys who were like all in, 100%, this is my job, I'm all in. It was them were the ones who were dying. A really good picture of mine. It's in me. It's all framed. There's six of us in that picture. And four of the guys in that picture didn't come back.
Yeah, I've seen that picture. You put that on social media, didn't you? I've seen that comment that you put.
All of those guys are commanders, and they are at the peak of in the battalion. They're the guys that are going to get them, who are going to win the fight for you. And they're the ones who get hurt, you know.
And while all this is going on, you're not thinking of the wider picture. You're just thinking about your day-to-day job and keeping the situation going.
No, just killing people. That's all we wanted to do. And I know, I don't mean to be brash about that, Tim.
Yeah.
And I don't want your listeners to go, he's a psycho. I am not. I'm a very well-tuned individual. But at the time, that's the warfighter mentality. And that's what we had. And we had to have that. And especially when you're losing friends, you know, the guy who sleeps facing you and he's not there no more. You're the best mate. He's gone too. And you're like, nah. When we go out, we kill people tonight. Any engagement, they all die. And that was the mentality we all had. We had to have that. And I'm not ashamed to say it. I'm not like that now. But for them periods of time, war fighters will understand it.
Yeah,
I get that.
Were there any injuries, like, you know, like other than fatalities? Like, what was the situation with injuries? And did you experience or see any mental injury, PTSD, or people who struggled or have struggled since then? Because, I mean, it must be like, I almost think there's an element of shame about it as well, that, you know, people don't want to admit to certain things, you know, depending on who you are, etc. But did you experience any of that, and how did you deal with things that you were doing each day?
So I had friends that were injured as well. A good friend of mine, Tony, was shot, injured, a major trauma to his arm at the time. Lots of other injuries like that, gunshot wounds, blast wounds. I didn't see, this might sound harsh, again, I don't want to sound like a lunatic here, but remember, I'm a young 27-year-old man who's just focused on war at the time. My brief to my guys was, when we go home, if I find out any of you guys playing this PTSD role and you're bitching, you're smashing things up, you're hitting your wife, I said, there'll be trouble. I go, because this is what we are paid to do. We are paid for war. And that's what we've trained you for. And that's the mindset. So at the time, anyone who I heard was like, oh, he's suffering. The attitude's right, he's a pussy. We don't want him. Get rid of him. We don't need him. He's a liability to us.
Yeah.
Because we were so focused. And that was the attitude. It was our attitude. It wasn't like it is now, where it's widely accepted, and rightly so.
So you're saying that was how you viewed it at the time?
Yeah. Like, for a long, long time.
Yeah.
For a long time, it took me many of years to understand what it was.
Yeah.
Until then, I just like your pussy.
Yeah. Have you ever had any difficult times relating back to it, thinking back about it, or do you feel that you've managed to navigate things fairly well?
So I don't want to, obviously, I know we're on a sort of time scale. Don't want to fast forward too much because we might talk again. But when I came home from Iraq, I kept a diary at the time.
Yeah.
And I got home and I was sat upstairs just randomly reading the diary. And it broke me. It just broke me, and I just burst into. I was reading about my friend John, and my feelings the night he died. I was writing about what happened to him, and I just broke into. I just uncontrolled. All I can think of when I think back now, getting goosebumps. I was like, you know, when a baby cries uncontrollably and it can't stop. You know, when you're a kid and you got that, but you can't breathe.
That type
of cry. It was that, and in the end, my wife had to come upstairs because I couldn't stop, and she had to calm me down. I just couldn't. And I was fine until I read that.
Yeah.
Read that page, and I was just destroyed. But half an hour, but I was all right after that. I think I just needed that, maybe.
Yeah, part of
and
it.
And I never thought of it ever again. I never felt like that ever again.
That's
that 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Sort
But that's really powerful. And in many ways, that's you processing it then, isn't it, when that kind of thing happens. But like I've read a lot about military stuff. I'm very interested in military stuff and history. And I've spoken to a lot of soldiers and the psychology of war, all this stuff. But, you know, to speak to someone like you who's been there in the thick of it and how you've processed it, how you've dealt with it, is incredible. And I think it's a very important story, not just a story, but like a human story about what the world's like, you know, and what these situations are like when they arise. Now, you were in Iraq. How long were you in Iraq for before you were moved to Afghanistan? Because technically Afghanistan, that war started earlier, didn't it? So you'd missed out earlier on. You went to Iraq once the insurgency was on. When did the Afghan thing fit in?
We'd spent, after Iraq, came home for a bit, and we spent a couple of years at home. And then again, it was like this lucky, we were all like desperate to get out to Afghan, like desperate. When we went, it was the most kinetic time. So we're like, this is amazing. So I think it was 2009, we went out, and it was like really kinetic again. I think I just want to ping on something you said there about, you know, understanding like, the, you know, this war, you know, that mindset. And for me, I think what made it really easy, I've said this before to people, I felt like we were indoctrinated for war. From the moment you're training, you start training, you go to like the sort of the infantry battle school, it's all about kill, 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 kill. And that's what it is. And it's like a mantra in your head, you know. And I'm not saying that they farm out a bunch of psychos, they don't. Yes, you find that when you get to the battalion, you know, there's some of the, like, the other operations you go on are nothing to do with war, the stabilization operations, and things like that. But our training is all focused on the killing of people. And that indoctrinates you to where it becomes normal for you. I had no qualms with killing people. It was like, yeah, good. I was like, good. I'm happy with that. Well, happy. And I think a lot of it's that indoctrination. Even the language and how we speak. So if we're given like a set of orders for an operation, it'll be to kill or destroy something. So even in the language, when you're talking about an operation, that language is going in your head. And especially like I'd been in 10 years before we went to war. So there's that build up of training. So then when it becomes you and you're leading these young lads, that's all you're feeding into their heads is just kill and destroy. Whenever we get into an engagement, we have to be at that level where we cannot think about it. It's got to be. And I think it's got to be like, we're going to kill everyone here today. We will come back okay, but they won't. And I think that helps you a lot. Now, someone could argue with me and go, well, that's what messed me up, thinking like that. For me, I thought of myself as a professional. It wasn't a job to me, it was my profession. So I didn't see it like, you know, like your job's, you know, I bet there's a guy out there, he's a postman, and he delivers his mail, cool, and that's what he does. But he doesn't go out there to do it as efficiently as he can. He just gets his job done while it's a job. And there'll be a mailman out there who's so proficient at it. He is so good, and this is his profession, and he does it to the best of his ability. That's what it's like in the military. And you get guys who are just really good at it, who like it, and they find all them other bits easy, I think. And you find out pretty soon whether you like it or not. You really do. You do. Yeah. And some people don't like it. You mentioned, like, we'll talk about Afghan. I'll give you an incident of one. We had a lad who was on a patrol. We moved into southern Helmand province, right down south of here, the most southern units in Helmand. And we were out on a foot patrol. We'd been on one night patrol. We just got into the patrol base, literally set ourselves up, sorted out our order of battle, who was doing what rotations we were going to be working in, and what teams were going to be doing what. And we'd had a blue on blue on our first like night patrol. So a blue on blues where a friendly call sign shoots at another friendly call sign. Or I'll call it a green on blue. It's where the Afghans shoot at you, the Afghan military.
The actual military, you're there to help. Yeah.
So we had like Afghan police sort of in sort of sentry positions around this base we were in. It was called Fabar Gael. And we were moving in one night. We were moving in at night. And I'm not joking. I was like, I'm sure we should be putting up some sort of light here. And the moment I said it, they engaged us. Because, and rightly so, they seen troops moving with no light. Because we're moving there at night. We don't have lights on. But I'm like, as an indicator, we need some sort of signal. And I was just thinking it to myself. I think I mentioned to one of the guys, as we approach, I'm sure we should be putting a bit of light in here. And the guys, the front guys, didn't put a light on, like an eye or like a little glow stick or something. And we got engaged. And the next day, that one of them guys who was at the front, he was out with us. And he just went, I am not going out again. And that was his whole approach to it. He goes, I'm not going out again. So trying to deal with that guy that day to get him off his arse onto his feet. We had to literally just get him and take him back to the patrol base.
Yeah.
He's like, this is not for me. And that's what he says. It's not for me.
Yeah.
It's not for me. And he didn't leave the patrol base for the whole rotation. He stayed in there and just manned the radio. It's not for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, they call that the fog of war, don't they? That kind of, everyone has this idea that, like, oh, yeah, you do this and this, but then there's chaos and communication breakdown and things go wrong. And then whose fault was that? Oh, I don't know. And it's like, you know, when soldiers are in high-pressure situations and they might do stuff that they're not supposed to, and you're like, well, there's a war going on, there's a survival instinct, there's all kinds of things that go wrong, the equipment goes wrong, you haven't got the right equipment. You know, all these things just compound the whole experience. But for him, he's travelling in the dark, you know, like the monster under your bed when you're a kid. Your own people are shooting at you, and it's just like a switch, you know. It's mad, isn't it? But what was the difference? What was the main difference? Because you had an insurgency in Iraq. In Afghan, you had, like, the official Afghan government who you're trying to prop up, as it were. And then you've got the Taliban who are on the ascendancy, getting supplied through Pakistan. You've got a porous border there with Pakistan. Obviously, they're quite far apart, but they're actually fairly close together. If you look at them on the map, they're not actually that far apart. So what was the key difference to you on the ground in terms of what was going on there?
Again, the geopolitics of it all didn't affect us. Again, it was all about, right, we're here to fight the Taliban, and that was it. There was no, again, I say again, no queen or country, no flying a flag. This is why we're here. We're out to fight a war, and that was it. And you think, when you get right down to the weeds of it, those guys who are doing the fighting, that's how they think.
Yeah.
It's the ones like above, the sort of, it's a bit more, there's a political element to it. For us on the ground, there's nothing like that. You're just out on patrol and let's get into a fight. Let's look for them and let's get into a fight. I think the biggest difference for me was, again, I was a bit more smarter. I've been in a few more years now. I'd learned a lot more. I was a bit more, I would say, calm under fire. If you didn't say that, I was battle-tested, so I knew that ticked the box. Didn't have to worry about that. Battle-tested, I knew how to deal with gunfights. And it was, we were all on foot the whole time. We were always on foot, so that was a different scope to it. Now we're not in like a built-up urban environment like Badger City. But now in some cases, it was farmland and jungle type environments. It's, even though I have been in the jungles several times, it's not a jungle per se, but when you get into them ditches with them reeds, it's got like a really close claustrophobic jungle feel to it, because you can't see sometimes a meter in front of you because the way the grass is and stuff like that. The sort of landscape of it looked different and it had a different feel to it. But the battles were the same. The gunfights were the same. There were no difference. I didn't see a difference in the enemy. We did fight. We did come up against some foreign fighters, I think, as well. Again, we did in Iraq. We came up against Iranian-backed militia and foreign fighters there. But we did the same. I think we had Chechens on the radio.
Yeah.
We have, like, interpreters on foot patrol with us, and they're like, this is not language. This is, like, they're speaking foreign languages here. So, yeah, we were going up against all sorts, to be fair.
It's mad, isn't it? Because, you know, when you say, like, the fighting, people have a perception, like, Afghanistan, oh, yeah, it's mainly desert and there's nowhere really to hide and there's this, like, kind of like little settlements here and there. But actually, it's got quite diverse in places, isn't it? As you've said, you've got jungle and you've got mountainous areas, and it can be hard when you're fighting in the mountains against people who know the mountains and you know like the back of the hand, etc. So, but for all intents and purposes, you're dealing with the same kind of thing. An enemy that are hidden away, you can be ambushed at any time. You're more on foot. And were you expected to cover more distances in Afghanistan on patrol, etc., compared to Iraq?
Not that we were expected to. We go out in what we call fighting patrols, and we'd have a certain distance we'd be moving to that day. It's not like, you know, older wars where the enemy's this side, you're that side, and you're trying to advance towards them to take ground. It wasn't like that. The battlefield's 360. We were going on fighting patrols to look for them, to engage. So what we do is we'd have females with us. Like, we had a clerk, so an administrator, and we'd take her on patrol, and she'd have a megaphone, and she'd shout the Taliban out. And the interpreter would say, look, there's no woman here, a British woman. She wants to fight you. You know, it's quite degrading to the Taliban. Yeah. There's a woman here ready to fight, and that would get them in the engagements. They'd start shooting it, and you can start to identify where they were, maneuver on them. But we'd use tactics like that to get them engaged in the fight, because, like you say, it's hard to identify them in the populace. Where we were in the green zone was farmland, very, you think, normal farm fields out in Lancashire, like that, you know, but with lots of green. It's very, very wet there. So it's irrigated. It was irrigated by the Americans along, you know, in the 60s. So lots of water, lots of streams to move. So I would just do that. I'd use streams to move in. I'd use culverts to move in, trying to avoid going on roads, because that's where predominantly they put on IEDs. Any crossing points that looked easy to cross, I'd avoid. I'd just make it a bit harder on the foot to patrol, but knowing that's probably a bit more safer. Because that's the less likely route to walk on. And, you know, for me, my patrols, we didn't hit an IED. Very lucky. Our teammates did. But my patrols never. We were quite lucky in that sense. But we still got into the same type of gunfights and stuff like that with people. I think it took a good one for you. We got ambushed, I'd say. Went out on a fighting patrol one night. I think it was part of a clearance operation, and my team were tasked with clearing, looking for to take contact on one side of a road to identify any threat. And nothing has happened. It's pretty boring. We'd found an IED on that. I sat there, highlighted it to the engineers. The engineers were dealing with that, so they couldn't bring the vehicles up. They had vehicles on a road. And just bored. Just sitting in the reeds. I was sitting in the reeds with my team, just like keeping cover. Sun was out, and an opportunity came for another task and to look for a crossing point for some vehicles. So I was like, all right, I'll do that. Yeah, I'll do that. So it meant pushing into a village. When I pushed into the village, I knew it was coming. So I set my team up into the right position. I was like, right, expect contact when we come around this corner, because I'd seen motorbikes leave, common indicator. Taliban are moving out on the bikes to set themselves up. I was like, right, stand by. And we did. We anticipated it. We were ready for it. We returned fire, did our manoeuvring, and we assaulted the position that we thought they were their last known position. Unfortunately for us, but fortunate for them, they'd extracted out undercover. But we needed a compound to be assaulted because there was another fighter, we thought. So we assaulted the compound and cleared it out. It was just women and kids. There was no one there. So we're like taking stock now. I've got my unit, my small 12 dudes is now bolstered by another 20 blokes have come in now. And we're sort of in these compounds. We're on the rooftops looking out, and we take an engagement. I'm climbing the roof to get better eyes on. I've got the commander of the company commander with me, platoon commander with me. So I can give them a lay of the land. This is what I'm looking at. This is where the threat was, and this is our next threat. And as I'm climbing up, I've torn my pants. I've got no underwear on. So my balls are hanging out. So I'm like, oh, my God. So I've got a few more days to wear these, because we're not going back in. You know, this is like a four-day patrol. So I'm like trying to trying to stitch them up with like an old bit of belt or whatever I was doing. I was trying to mend them anyway. And we got engaged again. And I'd spotted someone on a wall. So I got my sights up. We had the snipers with us. The snipers were looking one way. And I was like looking over the sniper's barrel. And the sniper's obviously desperate to shoot someone. Desperate. He's like, can't wait. And as I'm looking over through my sights, the guy's on the radio. He's commanding the team around him. He's a Taliban commander. So one shot at him, straight in the chest, with my balls hanging out. So, how many people have done that one?
I mean, as you say, like, you just, here I am, so is what I'm going to do, and you do it, you know what I mean? It's almost like every few seconds, you just, how can I get through the next few seconds, do you know what I mean? It's that kind of approach
normal.
To life.
It was normal to us, it was like, dead normal, this is what we do. There wasn't much fear, especially at that stage. I wasn't scared then. I'm quite a senior guy now. I'm like, I know my job inside out. Back to front, senior guy in the battalion, so very trustworthy, understand what I'm going to do. And so that day-to-day life of going out and fighting was just easy for me. I think I showed a lot more restraint in Afghanistan, and a lot of guys didn't. Seen a few things where I was a bit questionable. I'm like, right, come on, you need to show a little bit more restraint here. We are professionals, you know. So let's show that. Because we'd seen mistakes happen in Iraq where young lads had made bad choices and people had been killed. And later on, we'd gone, okay, at the time you thought it was this, but it wasn't. And it was a mistake. This is, like you said, the fog of war. But I didn't want them mistakes to happen again. So restraint, I was a bit more restrained when I got into gunfights.
Yeah.
We do it better.
Yeah. I mean, people have this idea, don't they, that like when there's an ambush, the first person automatically gets shot. You know, in a film, like there's a group going into somewhere and then there's one shot that kills the first person and then everyone's taking cover. And then, of course, it's never like how it is in films. I mean, some of it's quite realistic, I would assume, based on what you've seen. But
movies are realistic, some are not. But not everyone gets shot. They don't, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that ambush there, no one got shot. The guy was a bad shot when he missed us all. Yeah. Like 12 of us in a straight line walking at him. And, you know, he missed us all. So, but we didn't get him either. So we just got his mate later. So, you know, but some of the guys we had with us, like our snipers out there were amazing. Like hundreds, some of the kills they got were unbelievable. Good mate of mine on the snipers, you know, hitting two guys with one bullet on a motorbike. You know, this guy's legit. They became masters of the craft out in Afghanistan, the snipers. They really did. They were an asset. They were a real asset. And they won the battle for us a lot. Because they could just reach out further than the rest of us because we're our basic sights and basic rifles.
Is there a lot of boredom as well in war situations? You know, when you're back at base, I don't know, like if you go on a patrol, you come back, is it a few days? Maybe you're knackered, you've been out not sleeping well or whatever. Is there a lot of boredom and time filling at base as well? How does that kind of work?
It's very mundane. There's no air conditioning. We are sleeping in tents, so it's really hot. When you're not on patrol, it's roasting hot, like unbelievably hot. Afghanistan's a very hot country. Overall, I spent over 10 years living there. You know, it's very hot. And when you've got no aircon, you're sweating at night, you're fatigued, you're always tired, you're always knackered. But there's not much to do. Guys that play guitar, board games, you know, prepping food. We made, like, eating a big deal.
Yeah.
We made, like, a little kitchenette area out of nothing, out of scrap. And that became our thing, our big meal. And we pool all our food together and make a big meal for us all. And sit together and eat together. There's not much to do, to be fair.
Yeah.
But if anything, because you're moving at night as well, so you've got night patrols to go on. Guys have got to carry out, you know, security of the small fire base and stuff like that.
So how long were you in Afghanistan compared to Iraq then in total?
I did 4 months because I left a bit early. I was I'd already decided to leave the military. I'd had mates who'd left and who were going on what we call a circuit, doing close protection. And my mates were waiting. There was lads who were doing security, like security contractors were on the fire, like the patrol base I was at. Never spoke to them. They were civilians. They were doing their own thing. But my mate worked for the same company, and he was out in Helmand too. He was in my platoon in Iraq, and he was making like triple the money I was making. And he's like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "Bennett, leave and come and do this." So that was like my next step. That was already in my head. I was like, "Right, I'm going to do that." So, like, I was not meant to go to Afghan because I'd signed out the army. Normally, they don't let you go on operations. But I'd fought and argued for it. I was like, right, no, come on. We'll be the senior leadership courses prior for you. She wanted me to do that, so I've done that. So give me this. So they went, all right. So I went on the tour, but I did like a short 4 months, not the 6 months. So I had to come back and go on my course to become what you call a bodyguard, a close protection officer. And that was my next step once sort of AFCON was finished.
Do you know, we won't go into too much detail with the private protection and security today, but I've took up enough of your time. But what was the main difference? What was the similarity and the difference between those two roles, as it were? If you could just...
Totally different.
Where they are. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. But the same skills. You need the same... I was a firm believer that all the experience that I gained in the military helped me untold as a security contractor.
Yeah.
Because you're still getting shit. And it's not all the time. There are times when you get into engagements as a contractor, it just is what it is, or you get into an IED situation, or there's a threat that you've got to deal with. Those lessons that you learned, those skills that you picked up in the military, they helped me massively. And they made me a better security contractor. They really did. Yeah. 110%.
I mean, I've learned a lot just from speaking to you today, because although you speak well about it, it's like you speak with an honesty, like, oh no, this is what we were there to do and this is how we approached it. I mean, for you to use some of the way, like, we were indoctrinated, and afterwards I look back at it and thought, things went wrong on the field, so we don't want that to happen again. And you never really hear that from the horse's mouth, as it were. You know what I mean? Like, you get it through the media or through the films and the TV, etc. But to actually, for you to get your message out and say, this is what it was like and this is what we were doing. Like, when you were walking around, you weren't living in fear. You were actually wanting an engagement, because then you could do your job. You know, those kind of things. It just throws everyone on its head for what other people perceive it might be like. The reality is always completely different. But
it's a conscious decision, Tim, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
A lot of people will either, you know, play that bit down, or they just didn't think like that.
Mm.
But I want to be honest and say, this is how myself, my mates, that's how we thought. All of us thought like that. Them guys, like you've seen in that picture, all them guys thought like that.
Yeah.
All other ones who were not in the pictures, they all thought like that. Anyone who was really good at the job, that's how they thought. The ones who, not everyone thought like that. So we that's what we call ourselves, war fighters. We're war fighters. That's our job, is war fighting. I was in the army, because that's a big scope, innit?
Yeah.
So I go, no, I'm a war fighter.
Yeah.
This is my trade. Remember, like, as a kid, you go, like, you know, you say you join the army, get a trade. That was my trade.
Mm.
My trade was to close with and kill the enemy. That was my job. And we were good at it. That might sound like I'm being blasé or being a bit of a weirdo. It's not. That was our profession. So it's best to be truthful with that, isn't it? Rather than either
absolutely
play it down, and again, I'm not trying to big it up like some weirdo, you know, and not. That's just what we were thinking, like young soldier, 27, 30 year old men.
Yeah.
You were like, no, pros.
I think that your honesty shines through, though, because it's like you say, right, here's what it was like, here's what we were thinking, and here's what happened. And yeah, okay, there's some thinking back afterwards, but this is it. I think that the frankness and the honesty is just so good to hear, you know, because people don't get that, do they, through the media or whatever, unless they've been there. John, what we'll do is we'll put details for your gym on in the podcast notes as well, which I did when Kev was on. And we can share your Instagram if you want to, but I'll send the notes over to you and you can approve them first.
Thank you.
But thanks so much for your brutal honesty on the military machine, if you like, that you were involved in and the job that you did in Iraq and Afghanistan and how you approached it. It's so interesting to hear it from the horse's mouth, but with such honesty as well. So really appreciate what you've told us today. And I would like to do some more stuff with you in the future, you know, keeping it open as well. So, John, thanks very much for coming on and for being so honest. What a fantastic interview.